Welcome to Alchemical Dialogues, an Amber Light podcast. Join Dr. Henry Critella and Joel Lessies for their discussion on Nothing Wasted, Nothing Lost, Lessons Learned from Lived Experience. The information provided on this website and these podcasts is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this website and in these podcasts is intended to be a substitute for medical, health, therapeutic, diagnosis, or treatment. The opinions expressed by the guests in these podcasts are not necessarily the opinions of Amber Light International and anyone associated with this organization.
So welcome, everyone. I'm glad you could make it. Welcome, Joel.
Thank you so much for having me, Henry.
So a lot of you probably know Joel. For those of you who don't, though, Joel is a friend and colleague that we've been collaborating for many years. He does have something new. He's founded the Education Training Center. And it's a means of counseling people marginalized by trauma, addiction, and psychological distress. And those of you who know him, he's continued doing his work as hosting the podcast Unraveling Religion and looking at mystical and practical discussions, exploring spirituality, religion, and psychology. He founded and continues with the Ground and Sky poetry series, including Roundtable, where you just bring whatever you wish and recite, and also workshops. And we're starting an Amber Light edition of that in April, which I'm really excited about. He continues to work in his autobiography of poetry and prose entitled Odyssey of Autumn's Breath. And he has worked as a healthcare administrator, trainer, facilitator, consultant, leading the understanding of education, treatment, advocacy, especially regarding substance abuse, mental health, and medical issues. So welcome back, Joel.
I'm so excited to see you again and to see each of you and to have our talk today. I'm really excited about that, Henry. Yeah.
So in the past, we've talked about poetry and mysticism, and this one's a little different. We're really going to focus on your devotion and love of helping people in who have mental health distress. And we've touched on that in previous podcasts, but we haven't gone into it in as much depth as we think we're going to be doing today. So I'm really excited about that. And I thought we'd start with what really is behind your passion for this? How did you get into this?
Ground zero. Where do we start? How did I find myself on this path? Right. The very first steps I took onto this path. And so that's a complex question that one aspect sort of is beyond the scope of this conversation. But certainly as I incarnated into this world, what I was born into was a very discordian and chaotic environment. And immediately, when you are raised, as many people have been, more than maybe what we would assume, a caregiver that themselves has mental health distress, themselves are not healthy and healed, whole, happy, and adjusted well, the first interaction with that person began my journey with mental health distress.
So right from the start.
Right from the start.
In family of origin.
So if I could just tie this in very pointedly, that there are no accidents. I had a friend on Unraveling Religion, Gedalia Gerfine, who said, it's not like you were meant to be born in Cleveland, Ohio, and you wound up in Buffalo, New York. It's not like some gust of wind carried your soul to the wrong place. Like, you were born into where, what, when, why, and how of your experience or your mission to complete, specifically tailored for you. And so, yeah, I've had some mental health distress with good reason. But it certainly is a part of my journey and a part of my experience, which totally opens the whole field of conversation about what we're talking about today.
So for many people, they describe that as an experience that shuts them down. For you, it sounds like an experience that opened you up. Maybe right. Not right away, but eventually.
Well, so it's a great question. I mean, how did I get to this place of a vista, of a view that is panoramic and clear? It has not been an easy journey, let me assure you. There have been many people who have assisted me on my path and in my journey. There are people who've cried with me, struggled with me, who've supported me and loved me. And as I do my best to offer what I am able to give in each relationship, in each dynamic, so too I was served by many people in love to bring me to this place of understanding wholeness and health.
So in my psychiatric training, I was, let's see, this is going way back in the 70s, late 70s. And there was always this debate when dealing with people, and again, I'm not sure about your own mental health issues, but there was this debate about dealing with people with major mental health issues where the goal was to help them understand and derive meaning from it. Mm-hmm. But there was also people who couldn't tolerate that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the difference it makes is, idealistically, I guess I was coming from, well, yeah, you would think everybody would want to derive meaning from what happens to them.
Right.
But whoa, some people just can't or don't want to do that. What I learned is if you try to push that with people who can't, it's really disturbing. Yeah. If you don't do that with people who want and need to do that, right, it's equally disturbing.
Right. So yeah, in the documentary Crazy Wise, I think someone talks about there were two schools of thought a while ago, the covering and the uncovering, and the difference between them. And so I think one of the lessons that you can infer from what you just stated is that it points specifically to the fact that we are all so unique. We are all built so differently. And so in the mass expression, the mass array of different attributes of souls and the specific signature of each soul, we can sort of generalize that, yeah, there are some who don't want to know the meaning, aren't built for the meaning, and it doesn't benefit them. Well, there are others who, like me, the meaning informed everything about my healing journey.
So can you speak a little more about that? So I know you said you had a lot of help, uh-huh, people who were with you along the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When did you catch on that finding the meaning was really something you had to do?
Well, I mean, from my own experience, I had at the age of when traumatic experiences, there are two types. Let's talk about this from a psychological class, like a psychological teaching. Okay. There are two forms of memory. There are many forms of memory, but there are essentially two forms of memory that I want to talk about today. One is suppressed. So it bobs under the surface of the conscious mind. You know it's there, but you're not sure. It's not looked at. It's not examined. You kind of know what happened, but you're really not sure and you don't look at it. Then there's repressed, which we can talk about a whole host of sort of like differing professional opinions about whether repressed memories exist or not. But I'm fighting if someone tells me that repressed memories don't exist, because
yeah, I'm with you.
I've experienced them directly and I know for a fact that they do. And it's actually a brilliant mechanism of our psychology, psyche, and defense mechanisms that we do not harbor insanely traumatic events in our conscious mind. They are submerged into the unconscious until our being is ready to have them reemerge and we can handle or deal with them. So those are the two types of memory, suppressed and repressed. And I just, you know, when I found from my own experience that either suppressed or repressed memories, when I don't examine them, the events affect my behavior and I don't know why I'm acting the ways in which I'm acting. I'm acting out. You could say I'm acting out, saying things and doing things that are not what I really is in alignment with my true self, and can be hurtful and harmful to people when I say mean things, because I'm hurting and I don't know why I feel this way, but I just have to express this in this way because I'm disjointed in my organic experience, that I'm not whole, healthy, healed, and kind of like valuing my organic insights in myself, my organic phenomenological experiences.
So we just finished a short introduction to something we're developing in Amberlite called Revisioning the Ego. And yeah, we talked exactly about that. So for, you know, the take I have is very much like you're saying, and what I wanted to really resonate with is repressed impulses, memories, whatever you want to call them, have a lot of power. There's a use for it, as you said. I agree with you completely. But even when it's doing something helpful, like waiting for you to have the capacity to be able to deal with it, it's not like it's not leading you to do things.
Well, I think it points exactly for that reason to why meaning is important, because until I had a context for my behaviors and a reason why I was acting the way that I was acting, I didn't understand myself. So as I derived a context for the events that were causing me to behave in XYZ ways, and I dug deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper, I could see very clearly not just that these lost memories and lost experiences were driving my behavior, but there was wisdom in them that when I went deeply enough, I could begin to extract, and that wisdom became an offering of service to the community, which now I can guide people who have experienced in whatever measure trauma or memory issues of repressed or suppressed or just any kind of distress. Like I'm able to guide people now because of these experiences. So I look at my early childhood and adolescence as a kind of training, a kind of psychological training, like, you know, no PhD, no thank you, but am I well-versed in it? Yeah, I know it like the back of my hand. So, yeah.
So this may be jumping the gun a little bit, but is an intersection, it sounds like, well, I know from knowing you, of the psychological piece and the spiritual mystical piece.
Yeah.
Should we speak about that now?
Let's do that. What do we want? How do we want to begin that talk?
Well, when I trained as a psychiatrist, the mental health profession was really phobic.
Yeah.
About spirituality. It started to change before I retired.
Yeah.
But even then, it was, well, you have to, I'm going to exaggerate a little, but spirituality is important to some people's life, so you have to ask them about it. But there was such a paranoia about that's going to open Pandora's box and you're going to try to convert people to what your belief system is, that it was really hard to get beyond that.
Sure.
So there was a separation, at least in my training early on, from psychology and spirituality. And of course, most people know that Freud thought that religion was just a neurosis and an infantile complex. So it was actually, I never really felt that or saw that in my training. But that was probably before my time. But there was at least a split. When I did my training as a spiritual guide, the initial part is it was the same split, but on the other side. They were terrified of talking about psychology, in part because there was a fear that spiritual guides would turn into therapists when they didn't have the qualifications to do that.
Right.
And that started to change.
Right.
I had something to do with that, but certainly not just me. So I've always been fascinated. I don't think you can do either one without the other.
You cannot. It's not possible. It's just not possible. I mean, you know, I mean, let's look at it objectively. Let's look at why that would be the case objectively. Why isn't the physical just dealing with what we call the misnomer of a brain disorder? Is it a brain disorder? Is mental health a brain disorder when it doesn't function properly? Well, maybe it is. Isn't that just one side of a coin, though? I mean, we are matter. We are physical. We have a body. We have a rice. We are rice bags. We're in this incarnation, this body. But that's only half of the equation. The other half is that we are beyond time and space, and an essence of something that is transcendent. And we merge that limitless aspect, that unnameable aspect, into this physical container. And so if you look just at the brain disorder of the physical, okay, that may be the case. And you may be able to take a pill and quell some of the symptoms, but like why we are here, what and why we are doing here, the deeper questions are a part of that limitlessness, the soul. And so if you're not looking at that as what, and people are very fearful, just as you said, each on the other side is fearful of the other, but like what we need are people to fearlessly examine this human condition, scrutinize it. What is my mental health, my physical health, and my spiritual health? And my spiritual health is definitely tied into my mental health and my physical health, because everything here, and we all know this in different levels of understanding, everything here is a matter of energy. Like, our intentionality for life is what we experience. And when we put forth beautiful intention for service for others and kindness and compassion and courtesy, that returns to us like and kind and beauty and good feelings and validity of our experiences. And the opposite is true when we are agended with our intention. When we say we try to utilize our intention to secure some kind of agenda in our human condition that we think we want or are entitled to, that doesn't feel so good. And we know that. So the foundation of all this is energy. And that's what we are, is energy. We are in a form of consciousness. That's part of the human experience, but the body is also part of the human experience. The moderate vantage point or perspective is an understanding of both, the totality of both. And that's really why I feel like we talked about when I first experienced mental health distress, it's as soon as I incarnated, but that's not without reason. That's not without purpose. And what I'm expressing now is a manifestation of that mission and purpose, that I understand that it's a blending of the physical and the spiritual.
So it sounds like you started with, like we did with this podcast, the psychology of it. And we're making an artificial, I'm not sure I can make the distinction anymore between, I'm not saying it quite right. I don't think you can have real spirituality without paying attention to psychology and vice versa. But for purposes of discussion, it sounded like at first you were dealing with it more from a psychological vantage point, and mm-hmm. somehow it informed your developing spiritual opening and awareness.
Well, I love this. This is a very sensitive question. And how I want to answer it is it's a curiosity. We talked about each soul has its own signature or attributes or desires or mission. I have always been, as soon as I was exposed to mystical elements or deeper elements or spiritual elements in life, I was not exposed to them throughout high school. Not even until after college was I really ripe to receive them. But I began, as soon as I could, when I read The Snow Leopard, began to build a framework of understanding about the spiritual dimensions of my existence and of existence in general. And that foundation, that perspective, that building of a spiritual contextual framework, which I framed in the beginning talking about there's no accidents, that I'm born into this incarnation with reason and purpose, is very much tied into the mystical or spiritual understanding of things. So that the mystical or spiritual framework drew me out of the psychological distress, because I knew I had faith that my journey was not for naught, that it was informed, and I was here with a purpose and had faith that I would find meaning, although it was hidden from me, concealed from me in differing ways at differing points within my incarnation, within these experiences as Joel.
One of the Sufi masters, Pir Vilayat Inayat Khan, he has some teachings on spirituality and counseling. And just to paraphrase it, it was basically saying you have to kick it up a level, which is almost what I think you're saying. That sometimes you just deal with it, for you at least, or for people like us, you deal with it at a psychological level and it's not quite enough. You have to kick it up a level, and all of a sudden, there's more meaning, and you have a bigger context in which to hold your experiences. And that could be really healing.
It can be, because I'll tell you, the place that I'm at now with spirituality and practical experiences in life, there's zero distinction. That fully, if you want to be the most mystical, you are present without any trace of spirituality. There's no stink of Zen. There's no stink of, I am a spiritual person. We each are, I don't know how to say it, endowed with the original nature. And so in differing levels of forgetfulness and differing levels of concealment, our lack of recognition of what we truly are informs our journey and hinders our journey, but we are all making that movement toward awakening. We are all making the movement toward recognizing that we are spirit soul in a physical container. All of us, without distinction, without prejudice, every single being will come to this realization. Every single being will come to this awakening that I too am endowed with Buddha nature.
So, you know, it's fascinating. I had a laugh when you said the stink of Zen. So one of the movement, a very popular movement in psychology, which I really have grown to love, is the positive psychology movement. And it's the other side of the coin of what you're saying. So from a psychological approach, it's saying, here are the qualities that will make you happy and make your life more meaningful. And they're the same things that you're learning about in Zen or Sufism or Buddhism or Christianity. And George Valent, who's an expert on human development, is a Freudian analyst initially trained, which makes me laugh even more. The book's a little old now, but he wrote a book called Spiritual Evolution, which really caught my attention. And he takes a positive psychology framework and he says, this is spirituality. Yeah. Actualizing these psychological traits is spirituality.
Yeah, I take the slant a little bit differently, Henry. And I would say this, it's not a big distinction, it's a small distinction. But in the Talmud, in Torah, there's the oral tradition and the written tradition. The written tradition is the Bible, is the Torah, the written books of Moses and writings and prophets and all that. But there's the oral tradition, which was codified in the Talmud. And in the Talmud, it says, who is wealthy? Who is rich? He who is content with their lot. He who is sitting in the moment, every moment, understanding and seeing that what they have. What do they have? There's nothing they don't have. It's just what they identify with that prevents them from understanding that. So what do I mean by that? He who is content with their lot, they who are content with their lot, means very much you are inherently this moment. You are not separate from this moment. Therefore, you are this moment. And there's nothing that you do not access or have at your disposal that you need, that you don't need. So like the fullness of the spiritual experience is to have mushin or no mind, no-mindedly just being like a cat. You know, cats are terrific Zen masters. But this mushin or no mind eliminates distinction as well. Distinctions between I am Joel and you are Henry, or I am an executive director of education training center, or I am a man. Like, in this place of deep understanding, there is no thought, there is no belief, there is no construct, there is no identity. And so you don't need to, there's nothing to be added to this experience. There's nothing that you can become that you aren't already so fully that requires nothing else.
It sounds very Zen.
Well, you know, so when you say that, what are you asking or what are you implying? You're implying that there's a tradition that expresses these very deep understandings and teachings, but this is inherent birthright for all beings.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Zen is a drag race, a sprint to this understanding in a certain kind of way, more than maybe others. Different practices lend themselves to different qualities and benefits, but this deep awakening of what we are tends to be very precipitated by Zen practice. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like Zen reminds me that you're trying, it's a sprint, to use your word, to make sure you don't go anywhere because you're already there, which is an interesting paradox.
Let's look at truth. What is true, or what is truth? That is the truth. So then the question becomes, what is blocking my vision or understanding or perception of truth? If I am everything, why do I not understand that and experience that? You know, the Zen master Dogen had this very question. All beings are enlightened. Why don't they understand that they are enlightened? Why do we need to sit in Zazen to understand that we are awakened self?
So in your experience, how did your mental health experiences help you with all that?
Oh, I love this question. This is like the most beautiful question ever, because with the repressed memories, I went to Israel. I went on a 10-month social services program, Project Otzma. There I did a lot of introspection work because I had some really serious traumatic experiences in high school, which were totally discordian, meaning pure chaos and brutal and unspeakable. And I repressed those memories as soon as they happened. But I went after college, I went on this 10-month social services program. I had had enough time and distance from the experiences. So I began to do introspection very seriously. And out of that introspection began this question in me, because my experience was not organic, whole, healthy, and healed. My question became, what is the matter with me? And that question became a koan. So koan is an illogical question. It formed in China. Koans formed in China in Buddhism, in Chan, to awaken the student by shattering all conceptions of identity and construct in the mind. The illogical question shatters the constructs of belief and rational thought, discursive thought, to open beings up to the sheer presence of what they are, the sheer truth of what they are. And so my koan became, what is the matter with me? And this koan blew all the doors and windows out of my mind. Like, I just awoke at 24, and it was only the beginning of my journey. I mean, I had so much work to do. Only now have I really closed much of the suffering and trauma that I had experienced from birth to about 18. So it's directly tied. The mental health, the stress, and the spiritual inquiry are not different. They're the same thing. It's just that when we look through the lens of psychiatry, I've had so many different kinds of diagnoses. They've labeled me X, Y, and Z. And finally, because I've resolved things in a way, they can look back and in hindsight say, oh, this was a complex post-traumatic stress disorder. It was nothing else. But the symptoms, as you will appreciate, Henry, exhibited as if it were bipolar or schizoaffective or schizophrenia or whatever. But it was none of those things, because I don't, now that I've digested my trauma, I have none of those symptoms any longer. So it wasn't some organic illness. I was dealing with very complex trauma.
One of the points that we made about wanting to discuss were the lessons you learned from trauma.
Yeah.
Can you speak about that?
Lessons that I learned from trauma?
Mm-hmm.
I want to start by addressing this question by, you know, we have a mission and a purpose. I'm at this time and place. I could not imagine myself without these experiences. I'm so grateful for what those assholes taught me. I'm so grateful that those difficulties came to me, because it extracted something in my deep self that would not have come out otherwise. It was a test of my worth and my truth. So people who did harm to me, I honor them as teachers and they can go on their way. But I'm also grateful for what I've learned. The depth of my experience now is informed by those very difficult experiences. And the lessons of trauma are many. Marginalization, to be marginalized in a body and in a condition as a white male in America that you think I'd be mainstreamed in, I am. And I've had many, many things open for me because I am a white man. But I will also tell you that within that was a silent suffering of marginalization, which once I began to extract the understanding of that, I can identify now very deeply with marginalized peoples and groups and identities. Because, you know, I had experiences that marginalized me from mainstream conventional markers.
Mm-hmm.
That's the main lesson of the trauma, is that it informed me to be sensitive to marginalization.
So I wanted to back up, because you said something really poignant, that you're able to appreciate that you couldn't be the person you are without having gone through those experiences.
Yeah.
And it doesn't sound like I've had trouble with the phrase forgive and forget.
Yeah.
I tend to be more like forgive and not forget.
I couldn't agree with you more. There is no reason to forget when people are assholes. You know, there's no reason to forget that. I mean, you can forgive to let go of the energies and the ties and honor that. You know, let's talk about it from this lens. Like, You know, I took a very important instruction from the New Testament, because when Jesus was in front of, I don't know if it was Pontius or whatever, but, you know, Jesus informs him that, you know, he's like, dude, you would have no power over me if it were not given to you from above. I learned a lot from that, because I think that that is true of all of our circumstances. And so when we forgive, what are we doing? We're saying that it's not necessarily that person and me, but this has been orchestrated for my growth. So I don't need to hold on to it, and I don't need to have grudges against you for what you've done to me. That's between you and God. And the lessons that I can extract from these experiences, that's between me and God. And my work is to extract the lessons of the trauma to benefit others by as a guide, as providing a roadmap on how to heal. And in that way, you know, I can forgive what David did to me and what other people have done to me. Certainly, I harbor no ill will and no grudge. You know, may all their ill intention return to them like in kind as they expressed it. But I adhere to God. I adhere to the one that I feel protects and guides and is good. And so I have no problems remembering what they did to me, but I forgive them.
I think that's so important.
Yeah.
I think the forgetting piece is a mistake, because you don't learn if you don't remember.
Yeah.
But you can have the memory, but not hold on to the trauma, the emotional trauma. And that's what, if I hear you correctly, that's what you've been able to do and help other people do.
Yeah. And I think it's good. You know, there are a lot of dangers in this world. There are a lot of dangerous people in this world. So if you're forgiving and forgetting, and you're forgetting that this person is dangerous, you're bound to repeat that experience. But to forgive and remember is a much healthier way to go about things. At least that's been my experience, you know.
Right, that's been my experience too. It is kind of funny that, you know, in mental health, you try so hard to unlock the repressed memories so they don't drive you. But then there's kind of this expectation, oh, now that you've unlocked them, you need to forget them. No, you remember them and you integrate them.
Yeah.
When you're able to do that, right?
The way I describe my experiences to people that have not experienced trauma, it's like I visited a country that you can never imagine, that's real, that you can never imagine and you can never visit. And I may tell you about what the experiences were like, but it's no replacement for the experiences themselves. You know, I mean, those things informed me in a way and shaped me in a way that was brutal and terrifying and horrific, but also because of whatever grace was present in my life, now I see it as beautiful and a kind of like gift that was given to me by the universe. And I say that unequivocally, and that's not a quip. Like, that's my deepest experience and understanding.
You know, it's a very hopeful story.
Well, thank you. Yeah. I mean, not that I haven't worked my ass off. I've worked my ass off. I have worked my ass off to get to this place. I'm 53 and don't have many of the things that people on conventional trajectories have. I don't have a marriage. I don't have children. Those are things that I part of me would have liked, but I accept that this is the price of what I was required to do in this incarnation.
Even that context is very hopeful and helpful.
Yeah.
And it doesn't sound, the way you describe it, it doesn't even sound like, I'm struggling with the right word. It's not even a resignation. It's an understanding of, oh, this is who I am and that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, you come out of seeing what I've seen and you're at this level of like health. To me, I infer directly from that the universe has faith in me and who I am, because it sent me into difficult conditions and brought me through. And so there's a kind of confidence that the universe has in me that sent me on a difficult mission. You know, I have a friend who has DID, and DID is dissociative identity disorder. It's what used to be called multiple personality disorder. And they have multiple identities, and sometimes they lose track of time, and they struggle, and they're such a hardworking, fierce kind of like person. But I tell them, you know, as I feel for myself, I tell them, because I feel that this is true. I don't say it just to make them feel better, but I feel like, you know, it's kind of funny, but I say, You're on special assignment. You know, you've been given this assignment. You are on special assignment.
Right. I think that dovetails a question came in about, have you thought about how your path has affected other people?
Well, you know, there's this tendency in our culture to, and I want to take this in my own direction, but like, there's a tendency in our culture to measure how we affect things, like our identity, our role, our responsibility, our title. You know, I've impacted X, Y, Z. And I think that that's important in our culture. It's a measure of how we relate to others and how we establish like who is what and what. There are other cultures that have a different level of understanding where your life, your incarnation, your mode of service is an offering to community, which may be reflected back to you from time to time, but it's not something that you consider yourself as having done. Like you just keep moving forward and you don't really tie into an identity that I have affected X, Y, Z. And I adhere to the latter. I like that idea of like moving moment to moment, giving all I can of my heart to each person that I see in the ways that I can and just keep moving forward, keep growing, keep evolving, keep understanding, keep deepening, and giving what I can to who I can in the ways that I can and not really counting or measuring. So I don't mean to discount the question because it's a good question, but that's just my genuine response.
So there's a paradox in that, because one of the ways that we gauge some of those qualities or being more in touch with who we really are, or the Buddha nature that you talked about, is the vibrations we send out into the world and what happens around us.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if you get too focused on, well, I need to see what effect I had in the world around me, and it gets in the way of that.
Right.
It's a real interesting paradox. And some of the studies we've been doing, the phrase that we keep using that we've actually taken from David Spangler is sovereignty, where you are centered in, this is it. This is who I am, and this is what I'm meant to do.
And
from the Sufi point of view, the phrase that's often used is independence and indifference. Take it too far, it sounds callous.
Right.
I don't care. I could care less what happens to you. I'm only interested in me. That's not it.
No. Nor is it the reverse. Nor is it that I care solely about how other people perceive me.
Correct. Yeah. But that's an interesting line to be, line is the wrong word, but I can feel it. Putting it into words so it's not misunderstood, I think it's a felt experience.
I think so too. And I, again, that's why I kind of prefaced it by saying, I don't mean to discount the question or the perspective. I'm giving my secret self and my deep self, I'm bringing that out into the light and saying, this is how I try at least to look at it. I try not to, like, it's so wonderful when someone says like that someone appreciates what I've done for them. We all feel this way when we feel validated. But what I think I'm trying to articulate is that it's really for others. It's for others to, my experience of others is another's experience. It is not mine. That we may relate in the moment in relationship, but it's really there. I don't need to know, but if it reflected back to me or comes back to me, that's wonderful too. So a kind of middle way with it. Yeah.
So one of the points you highlighted when we were talking about doing this podcast is how your experiences may be a calling to be a healer, leader, teacher in the community.
Yeah.
And I think you said it in the very beginning, being of service has become really important.
Yeah. Well, it's the lifeblood of my existence. It's not anything other. I don't mean to, you know, I say this unequivocally and with no limits on it, that if I've stopped serving other people, I was just talking about this with a friend of mine, that I would not have healed if I was not in service to others. If I was trying to heal myself without giving to others, there would be no healing. The totality of healing comes in how much we can give to other people. And that's the great paradox of existence that I've learned in my spiritual investigations, is that the more I effing give to others, even when I'm in distress, in the moment, it may be terrible and difficult and hurt. I know that returns to me, and I know it's correct because we are all the same self. And to step out of my paradigm into another's world, even when it's difficult for me, that extra effort also returns to me. So like, just that, you know, I just think that like, there is no healing without service. And the more you serve, the greater your healing, the deeper the healing will be.
But not if the focus is counting up how many people you served and putting the feather in your cap.
So let's examine why that's the case. I mean, that's a common thing for people to do. I mean, why would that be that we don't countermeasure? And I'm pretty overt about the fact that I believe in an orchestrator, an author, you know, God, you can call it God. You know, there's an orchestrator or authored all this. But another word that you could use is an accountant. God is the great accountant. So like I serve people and it, God, it does all the math. I don't need to worry about the math.
Right.
And so that level of faith I know is different than some people and measured in an equal measure with others. But like truly, when you stop counting and you allow God to count, that's a freedom.
That's the independence and indifference.
That's sovereignty. That's honoring your sovereignty because we are created by something that sent us here. And when we honor it by giving it all to him in trust or it or her in trust that I will be taken care of if I give everything I can to this community and build it in the ways that I am meant and let it count, there's such freedom in that. I can't tell you. And the inverse of that would be to like, in my mind, be clouded by, oh, I helped X, Y, and Z person, or I did this or that or the other thing, or I gave this amount of money to this organization. Like, who needs that? Is that really your money? Is that really your giving? I mean, so it ties into a much deeper question of like, when we give, is that just us or are we allowed to give? When we give, are we emulating something that is given to us and we are passing it along? Am I the sole source of giving or is there something that has imbued me with the ability to give that I don't need to count or measure and I'm just passing along? It ties into this just briefly, if I could say, there's a movie called Amongst White Clouds, Edward Berger. And he was a college student who read Chan Hermit poets. And he went to China to find living today contemporary Chan mountain poets in China. And he found these guys and they had they were ascetics. So they had tattered robes. They lived in some shack. And, you know, he had all this rice and food and oil. He tried to give it to them and he stayed a couple days. And he noticed that as other people came, they took the stuff and then gave it away. Like they didn't want it. They didn't need it. You know, they want only what they need. And I think that that's a fundamental point of scrutiny for people is that we should examine what do I need versus what do I want? There's a big distinction.
Again, we could go around in circles. I remember when I was studying Tibetan Buddhism, I think I read it as opposed to a conversation, but somebody was saying, you notice how as the Rinpoches get older and they get deeper and deeper, they create more monasteries.
Yeah.
They don't slow down. They get more energized and monasteries are popping up all over the place, yeah. Which can sound the opposite of what you're talking about.
Yeah.
So there's this, maybe this is another podcast. I think this is it's something that I think is important and can be really confusing.
Yeah.
And I love the way you're describing it. One of my favorite stories, I know some of you on the call have heard this, but I read an autobiography of Jackie Chan, the comedic martial artist.
Yeah.
And it really moved me. And the story it reminds me a little bit about your story. He said that his parents couldn't afford to raise him, and they put him in an orphanage, which at that point, the orphanages were training the kids to be in the Chinese opera,
yeah,
which was basically gymnastics. And he said his parents had to sign a piece of paper saying that the orphanage was not responsible if he died.
Yeah.
He said the training was brutal.
Yeah.
It was abusive. Nobody should ever have to go through that.
Yeah.
He's glad they're closed down. It was a terrible experience. And then he says, and I thank them every day because they made me who I am.
Yeah.
And I read that and I just stopped. Yep. You know, I think I understand better what he's saying.
Yep.
To have that kind of, basically, I would like to be a part of never having this happen to any child ever again. But I have to tell you, that's why I am who I am.
Yeah.
And part of the way he handled it is he made the inroads into the movies. And he kept on giving, he hired his orphanage partners as stunt people. He started giving them jobs. I mean, he just gave back to the community and he helped the people exercise what they had learned in this awful experience. That is a piece of work. Mm-hmm. What a magnificent human being to be able to hold it that way. And that's what your story reminds me of.
Thank you so much for saying so. Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things that I'd like to say also is that in this mode of talking about the container, the rice bag that we are versus the timeless element that we are, the soul, and that soul is energetic, has energetic properties, which can manifest in intention. So when there's a specific point of wanting something in energetically in intention, it very often can be obtained, but you are narrowing the focus, putting almost like blinders on what might be available to you if your intention becomes, how may I serve? How may I serve Creator? How may I serve my community? That open intention releases a field of possibility that you cannot imagine can return to you in ways that make sense and affect others in ways that are very profound. And so I just wanted to say that because I think it's important because, I think like, I want that new Mercedes Benz, or how may I serve? I mean, we can each choose in that spectrum of where we want to be.
Mm-hmm. Great. I want to talk a little about your education training center.
Yeah, please. Yeah.
Well, no, that's an invitation for you to talk about it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, sure. I can do that. Education training center. I'm actually just in process of completing paperwork for a 501c3, which makes it a nonprofit. And the mission of education training center is very specific. It is to deal with mental health distress, addressing mental health distress without distinction to cause. So that what does that mean? That means that like if you have trauma from a non-binary experience, identifying as non-binary, or you are purple and everyone else is green, or you are in the LGBTQ plus community, whatever ways in which we are feeling marginalized that's causing distress, Education Training Center has been set up to address that distress without distinction to cause. Who cares why it happened? You're in distress. Let's figure it out. And so within the AGs of Education Training Center, I had a lot of hobbies, which I was able to assemble under the shield of Education Training Center, including the Unraveling Religion podcast, which Henry's been a guest, Betty's been a guest, and the Ground and Sky poetry series, which we talked about in the beginning of the show. I also offer individual and group counseling, and I have a contract with Compeer Rochester to provide groups, weekly groups called On the Menu, which deals with targeting the understanding of isolation and loneliness and mental health. And I also offer other things like trainings and events. So I do mental health first aid training, which is a 7.5 hour course in how to interact with individuals in mental health distress in the moment. It gives people confidence. There's an acronym called ALGI. It's assess for risk of suicide or harm, listen non-judgmentally, give reassurance and support, and then encourage appropriate professional help, and then encourage like self health, so things for self help. And so that's essentially the ALGI acronym is we dissect that in mental health first aid training in a wide array of ways. And I was trained in Albany to provide that training. So Education Training Center provides mental health first aid training. I'm actually providing it for a spiritual organization in Rochester coming up. And then I also do community events. So one of the things that I was able to do a long time ago was bring the documentary Crazy Wise to Rochester and Buffalo. And I documented those experiences with short videos. There are about 8 or 9 of them. And those are on Vimeo, but it's on the website. So if you ever wanted to take a look at those, I sunk my heart and soul into those as well. And so we do community events. And one of the things that I'm looking at doing in August is I'm having a panel discussion on forced treatment. So we are going to talk about with a panel of anthropologists and global health, global mental health, and psychiatrists and advocates, a panel of 7 I'm going to moderate, about what forced treatment looks like and where it needs to go. I think for me, there's no question that what we call forced treatment or the forcing an individual to take medication at times may be appropriate, but how it's done is inhumane and pretty upsetting. So I think the ways in which we do it, that it may need to happen, can happen, but we need to examine the paradigm from which it is implemented. And that's pretty much it. Education Training Center. So, and then the last thing about Education Training Center is on Saturdays at 2:00, we hold a half an hour meditation session because Education Training Center understands the vital link between meditation and mental health. Meditation has been vital in my own recovery and my own rehabilitation and extracting many of the lessons of trauma.
That's quite a basket. You have a lot of things going on with that. Congratulations. So people can find your website, right?
Yeah, it's up. It's just my name.com. So it's joellessies.com, and that's Education Training Center. You know, the Unraveling Religion podcast, you can find links there. The Ground and Sky poetry series, which I want to fully express it, is on Zoom. So even if you're not in the Western New York region and you are interested in Ground and Sky poetry series, there is a Zoom option available for people.
Great. So, I wanted to talk about the Amber Light edition.
Yeah.
I still love that you came up with that phrase.
Yeah. Yeah. You want me to talk about it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, many years ago, I met Henry at Sufi's Universal Worship. And something that was really a wonderful experience was at Universal Worship. And for a long time, we've stayed in touch through the years, and we've begun to collaborate on many different projects in many different ways. And I think we spoke recently about Ground and Sky Poetry Series, which has a no mic, no list, no podium format. What does that mean? It means we just sit around and talk about life, and people throw poems in, and there's nothing you got to do. There's nothing you got to say. There's no poem you have to read. You can read other people's poems. I joke with Henry that you can bring a tuba. That's okay too. And so that no mic, no list, no podium format, Henry and I spoke about wanting to offer it to the Amber Light community. And so in Rochester, on the third Friday of every month at 7:00 at Before Your Quiet Eyes bookstore on Monroe Avenue, we are going to offer the Ground and Sky Roundtable Amber Light edition of poetry.
So I guess we're not joking about you can bring a tuba.
No.
So it isn't just poetry. It's anything, any art form you want to bring.
Yeah, totally.
So we're
prose or poetry, musical instrument, drums, right. Saxophone, yeah,
whatever. Right. We'll see what kind of collection we get. So that starts in April. So if you're interested, contact me or contact Joel. Joel is going to do all the, it's a hybrid event, and he's going to take care of all the Zooming. So, but you can contact either one of us, and I will send out the Zoom link to anybody who contacts me, and Joel will send it out to anybody who contacts him. But if you're in Rochester or within striking distance, feel free to come. It's Before Your Quiet Eyes bookstore.
Yeah, Ken Kalbaugh. Yeah, Ken Kalbaugh is a wonderful guy, and he runs a wonderful, it's really a bookstore, but it's a community center. I mean, there's a whole culture that's formed around it.
Right. So Louise put into the chat for those of you on the recording how you can contact me. If you already know me personally, you can just send me a personal email. Otherwise, just use the info@amberlightinternational.org. So yeah, so we have a lot of interesting things that are developing. And I think one of the interesting, exciting things for me in working with you is how things have, these artificial distinctions have, in a very organic, experiential way, have just started to collapse. So we talk about psychology, we talk about spirituality, we talk about Zen, we talk about the Torah, we talk about Sufism, but really the experience has become, it's all one.
Yeah.
And having that happen has been a real gift to me. It's not abstract. It comes out in my life. It comes out in our conversations. And that gives a lot of meaning to my life. So I really appreciate our friendship and collegiality. And we can still get off. We could talk for 2 hours about one little thing in psychology or mysticism. But the experience is, look at how it's all coming together, how it's all integrating, and not getting caught. We help each other, I think. My experience is you help me not getting caught in just one thing that I'm interested in and forgetting, no, there's another way of looking at this. And that allows me to stay open and to be more able to share somebody else's experience in a really meaningful way. So thank you, dear friend.
You are my dear friend. Each of you in different ways. Some I may not have met, but many of you are deep treasures to me. Luis and Betty, for sure.
Yeah. So we're going to be wrapping up. If there's any comments anyone would like to make or any last questions. So Kathleen has one, and then two people have raised their hand. So Kathleen.
Hi, Joel.
Hi, Kathleen.
I'd like to ask you if you have an opportunity to teach the spiritual or the mental health emergency course to first responders, police, fire, EMT.
Well, it's a great question. And there's actually New York State legislation to mandate that teachers and first responders, including police and EMTs, it's in legislation, it's not passed. So it's not mandated, it's not law. I don't know where it stands, but I know that there was legislation to get that passed, to have all, and just to open this up in a genuine way, because I feel as I'm more genuine about my story, other people, gives permission for other people to. In 2019, I was not doing well, and I was arrested in Brighton, running down Monroe Avenue. I couldn't believe the cop caught up with me. I'm still astounded by that. But, you know, I just reached out to the police chief, I think, last week and thanked him for the exceptional care and compassion, professionalism that they provided. And I did that for no reason. But then I was like, oh, and there's this thing, mental health first aid training you guys could do. And he wrote back this beautiful email that was like, I'm so glad that you're well now. Thank you so much for your response. And just to let you know, Brighton has sent someone to Georgia a few years ago, to be trained in mental health first aid training in-house, so they can train all the new police officers and the current ones in mental health first aid training. And we agreed sort of in this way that one of the reasons why the response was so loving and professional and appropriate in my condition, my state, was because of the mental health first aid training. So I was really very happy with that knowledge that mental health first aid, which I'm a trainer in, came back in a way to like really help me very deeply. It could have gone many different ways. Not everyone always gets out as well as I did. So
I just want to ask you if that's Chief David Cataldi.
Right. It is. Yeah. Yeah.
Or he's a forward thinker.
He was so loving. I mean, I have the email here, and I just couldn't believe that, you know. And so I have it right here. Yeah. Cataldi. Yeah. That's who it was. Yep. And so yes, I can provide that training. I think I have to examine whether I have to get a sub certification within to train specific populations. but that would not be difficult for me to do if you're interested in that. But there are also, just to let you know, Kathleen, there are many very, very qualified people in Rochester who could also provide that training if you're interested in promoting
that. So thank you for offering to talk with her about that. So, Scott?
Thank you, Joel and Henry. I'd just like to begin by saying I think this is a very worthwhile subject and topic, and I think you should do this again and dig a little deeper, you guys. You both, your experiences show that, you know, we've really basically just touched the surface. I guess my question began as something that maybe concerns a present issue, such as the one we've experienced, national epidemic of gun violence in school, you know, especially the recent ones that have happened in schools, where there's obviously a feature of real mental distress driving perpetrators. And, you know, sometimes we forget that perpetrators are the most traumatized. And it demonstrates in a way how there's something in the pipeline, you know, if we want to think of, you know, society as a pipeline, you know, where it's, well, you know, we have it for a particular reason. You know, it's supposed to get from here to there, right? Whatever is in the pipeline. And, you know, it just, I was thinking in terms of, well, you know, what could communities have that, you know, escape this stigma or even the understanding of what, you know, mental health or specific mental health intervention is, that, you know, would really create an environment of, or an improvement in a community's overall mental health. That led me then to, remember a recent experience. I follow the, I think at Library of the Americans, America. They do some great books and they publish all the time, everything, you know, all these great American authors, everyone from Jack Kerouac to Frederick Douglass and that. But they recently had a book that they were releasing, which is, I believe, called Women Are the Future. And it was about science fiction writers who are women and how different their views might be of, you know, possible future society. Basically, you know, that was something that they really touched on. It wasn't just the traditional, you know, scientific, science fiction, you know, with aliens invading from outer space and, you know, women having these roles where they needed to be rescued by someone or something. Anyway, there's a science fiction book that I've read in the 80s, and it was Marge Piercy's book, and it was called Women on the Edge of Time. If you're not familiar with it, it's the story of a woman who is diagnosed as being schizophrenic. But her experience is that she actually travels into the future, into a society that's completely different. And for all intents and purposes, it's reality to her. So she's caught in the paradigm of having to actually believe in both this world and the other world she's experienced as being reality. Okay. And so, well, it boils down through some rather traumatic events, but some were, you know, very reaffirming as far as ideas that could maybe express what a more holistic society would be. In the future, the camps of society were divided into one was kind of like a...
Scott, I'm going to have to ask you to kind of wrap up the question.
Okay. Well, I'll just say that you should read the book. It's really, it's an amazing book. It really is. If I stop now, there won't be any spoilers. But it's a great subject for mental health and... looking forward, Tyke.
Scott, if I could just say quickly, very briefly, your question about gun violence or just general violence toward the community by an individual who's crying out, we have to investigate that very deeply, because there's this tendency to blame gun violence on mental illness, and that's not a correlation that pans out in sort of the research. So one of the things I would say is that there's a capacity of every soul to hold their suffering and their trauma. The larger the capacity of a soul to hold its trauma, the more it's easier for it to extract the lessons. The smaller the soul's capacity to hold, the more likely that they'll react in some kind of violent way to the community.
So I really wanted to highlight what Joel was saying, that in general, the issues with mental illness tend to be what he highlighted earlier, isolation, marginalization. Statistically, they're not the cause for this. And
if I could introduce this to Henry, it's 10 times more likely that a person with mental health distress will be the recipient of a crime.
It's always been that way. Yeah. I remember when I was practicing that was emphasized so much, and I was working in some difficult inpatient facilities where there was a lot of violence. And I remember somebody gave a talk and was giving a seminar on how do you deal with the violence in institutions with people who have significant mental illness. And I went up and said, I just want to shake your hand because you're willing to talk about this. It's the other side of it. It's not that it doesn't happen, but the way it's being talked about now in the public forums is as if, well, the whole reason for this is because of mental illness and we need to have that under control and provide better services. It's like there's a disconnect in there that really bothers me. So that's one part. The other part is, yeah, we could have a whole other podcast on, and we touched on it a little bit, how certain kinds of mental illness can be an opening to a spiritual experience. That doesn't necessarily mean that every suffering, every person who has a mental illness and is suffering is having a mystical experience. It's not either or, it's also and. And it's sometimes hard to differentiate that. And that's important. If somebody is having an opening, you don't want to shut that down. You want to integrate that. On the other hand, if somebody is suffering with a mental illness, they're suffering. There are things you can do that will be really helpful that don't necessarily shut down their being able to have meaning in their life. It just allows them to be safe and to function while they're integrating all of that. So thank you for the invitation. That's something maybe Joel and I, we can talk about doing another podcast on. Yeah, Betty, you had a comment or a question?
Hey, thank you. Hi, Joel. Thank you so much for your authenticity and openness in sharing your experiences and the wealth of wisdom and knowledge that you have. Thank you for sharing. I actually have two questions. I'll try to quickly kind of combine them. I was wondering if you would share with us, in retrospect, what you consider some of your strengths that have helped you move through your life and find yourself where you are today. And the second part, the second question is, actually, it kind of tags onto something Scott said, and that it is because of technology today, we, by and large, so many people are witnesses to trauma, to other people having trauma. And we kind of experience that as trauma, as a traumatic experience ourselves by seeing so much of what's happening. You had mentioned meditation, and I was wondering if that is one of the tools, and if there are other tools or activities that from your experience you can share that might help us to, you know, just to kind of maintain balance and tread this rocky, turvy, topsy-turvy world that we are living in today.
It's a pretty crazy place, isn't it, Betty?
Yeah.
So those two questions, sort of the strengths that allowed me to survive and kind of what are the tools that we could utilize for others? It's funny, there are different ways I could approach this question about strengths, but I want to approach it this way, and it's a very intimate expression. And there's something about my dynamic with Henry and each of you that allows me to express myself without fear of judgment. I feel safe and in a trusted, safe space. And I think that Henry's energy and Louise's energy and Betty's energy and each of you allow that to come to be into being. But I will say this, that I was saved, or I was healed, or I am well now because of my ability to bond with people in deep ways. I have a tendency to have deep relationships with people, and that allows deep insight and deep vulnerability and deep understanding. And it is the most cherished aspect of my human existence that I can bond deeply with people. I would not trade this existence for anything in the world. It is so inexpressibly wonderful that we can be in these containers separate, isolated, lonely, and then connect deeply with people, especially when we need to be heard. And so I've had a series, there's a poem that I have called Turn My Neck Behind Me, Gazing on My Past Retrospective, in which I sort of cite four relationships that I had that were the foundation of my well-being today. And so I would say that that is the very essence. My ability to connect deeply with people is the reason why I'm well now. As far as what we can do for people in distress, because Education Training Center addresses mental health distress without distinction to cause, so it doesn't matter. These things that I'm going to offer are not based on any kind of specific reason for mental health distress. Meditation is paramount. And what does meditation offer but the ability to witness oneself and others in an open, receptive way? And that witnessing, I would say, is foundational for healing for all people. What would the world look like if I didn't have to say anything to you, but I could just hold space for you? And we did that for each of us, everyone, all the time. And then we only uttered what was true and deep and genuine in our heart, that we didn't utter something about some sale at XYZ place for a cola or gas on sale, but we were talking about what is real to us, what is genuine beyond identity, beyond practical concerns of finances, into the heart of the matter of being human. And listening, so witnessing, listening, and sort of assessing, cultivating through meditation our ability to respond to circumstances. I would just say that. You know, I would say, Henry, it feels like, if I could just be very forthright, it feels like a second installment of this, because I feel like we've only grazed the surface. I feel Scott was so right on the money. And I, you know, it's not my place to offer that, but like, be interested in me.
You have an invitation. I wanted to dovetail on what you were saying, though. Two things. One is, you know, I'm blocking on the researcher in the book now, which is embarrassing. But the research was about small things you could do that have a big effect. And one of them was about service, and it had to do with labeling. And it was really interesting. It was the experience of kids and adolescents who had behavior problems that were getting them into serious trouble with police, et cetera. And what the research found is if they volunteer to provide service, it creates cognitive dissonance. I can't be volunteering and enjoying this if I'm getting in trouble all the time. And they did research on summer camps for kids who hit summer camps for kids. And kids who have trouble going to summer camps for kids who have trouble versus kids who have trouble who just go to a summer camp.
Yeah.
Dramatic difference.
Yeah.
Go to a summer camp for kids who have trouble, your behavior stays the same or gets worse.
Yeah.
If you go to a summer camp just to have a summer camp experience, all of a sudden, there's improvement.
Yeah.
So part of that had to do with reframing and relabeling.
Yeah.
Saying, you are not what society is saying you are.
Yeah.
But you have to embody that, and you give them experience. You know, like, you can't have a volunteer opportunity only for kids who are having problems. They just have to be volunteering. Mm-hmm. So that's probably the trick. So that was one. So, and I wanted to highlight it because what I heard is one of the strengths and one of the things that helped you deal with what you were dealing with was service.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much. Very much.
The other part is going to be, I don't want this to be like a naysayer, but there's a lot being written, rightfully so, about one of the, quote, dangers, end quote, of meditation that hasn't been spoken about enough. But it dovetails with what you started with, and that is it often de-represses the repressed memories.
Sure.
Which is, on the one hand, good, which is the way you experienced it. Uh-huh. On the other hand, when you're not ready for that, yeah. or the person who is guiding you or teaching meditation isn't aware that that can happen.
Yeah.
Well, what's really bad is if you emphasize that and then meditation, oh, you shouldn't be doing that because it's so dangerous. No, but you can't be blind to that. And I just wanted to highlight that. It's a wonderful tool, but you have to be aware, especially when there's trauma involved.
Yeah.
That can happen. Well, Joel, thank you very much. We're going to have to stop. So, yes, you and I can talk about part two.
Beautiful. I want to thank each of you for creating a safe space for me to express some very vulnerable things. So thank you so much.
You know, before we end, I thank you so much for saying that. All of these podcasts that in Unraveling Religions is a very safe space for me to just wax eloquently when you provoke me. And I think we've developed something that the safe space is really important to me. So you feeling safe enough to share some really poignant and intimate experiences. Thank you so much for doing that. And thank everybody who's been listening, whether you're here on the recording or not, for making it a safe place for people to really explore, have a conversation that can let something new arise that's beneficial for people. And I really appreciate that. So thank you all. Take care.
If you find yourself enjoying our podcasts, please do us a favor and spread the word. Tell a friend about it. Give us a review on iTunes or post it on social media. If you or someone you know would like to participate in a future podcast, please connect with us through the Contact Us page. See our events calendar page for dates to our next live podcast recordings. We'd love for you to participate and ask questions. And be sure to check out Joel Lessie's podcast, Unraveling Religion, on your favorite podcast app. Alchemical Dialogues are live and unscripted conversations recorded on Zoom, brought to you by the great folks of Amber Light International, a nonprofit organization co-founded by Henry Curtella, MD, and Kathleen Fitzpatrick, LCSW. We choose topics from our current social and cultural climate with an emphasis on humanism and spirituality.